down. I won't shut up. And most of all, I will not grow up. I won't sit down.
Okay, this is Rish Outfield. Welcome back to the Rish Outcast. We're going to be doing part two of The Ugly Table. It was never intended to be split in two, but the episode was just so long that, well, I made a decision. I'm sure the story itself works better listened to all in one sitting. But what can you do? And this was originally all I was going to record is, you know, we pick up the story already in progress, but today's my day off, and I was going to meet Big to do Doonstief, and it's fall when I'm recording this, and so I sort of ignore the hazards of summer. But I guess it was really, really sunny today, and when I got out to my car, there was a Mr. Pibb can sitting in between the seats, and it was completely empty. The contents of said Mr. Pibb can had exploded all over the front seat, the windshield, the ceiling, the passenger seat, and the driver's side window. So I spent the last 20 minutes trying to clean that. I didn't get all of it. I can see a couple of little spots right here in front of me. It's impissing. You know, I mean, it's not the end of the world or anything like that, but it was a dumb thing that I did. And the weird thing is, I think that Mr. Pibb can had been in the car for like the last 10 days or week and a half or something because it's been cool. In fact, there was one day that I got its brother, can, out of the car, and because it had been cold all night, it was nice and fresh and cold for me. You heard it. You heard me opening the Mr. Pibb the other day when I was recording the first introduction of The Ugly Table. Anyway, I don't know why I'm telling you this, just to complain, I guess, but I like Mr. Pibb. It reminds me of a story. Oh, there's a guy tailgating on me. I don't know how long he's been. I've been wrapped up in recording this, but he's just like right on top of me, 8-9 feet. I wish I could get some Mr. Pibb onto that person. Onto their dead body, really. Anyway, I digress. I like Mr. Pibb a lot. I didn't used to even know what Mr. Pibb was, but here's a tiny little story about my introduction to Mr. Pibb. My friend Jeff adores Dr. Pepper. I wish I loved anything as much as Jeff loves Dr. Pepper. He can't live without it, and why would you want to? And we were at a restaurant, 15 years ago, maybe longer. Holy cow, it might have been before I moved to Los Angeles. It was one of those restaurants that, and I can't remember, some restaurants have only Coke products and some restaurants only have Pepsi products. And let's just say that she only had Coke products at this one. The waitress said, you know, do you want a Coke? And I said, do you have like a cherry Coke? And she said, no. And I said, well, I guess I'll have a Coke. I'm not a Coke fan. But Jeff will not drink Coke. He absolutely hates it. But he's equally blessed in that he hates Pepsi, too. He just hates the taste of cola, he says. And so he asked the waitress, well, do you have Dr. Pepper? And she smiled and said, we have Dr. Pibb. And Jeff, he just flew off the handle. And he says, there's no such thing as Dr. Pibb. It's like, you're talking about Mr. Pibb. I will just have water. And for the next like 5 minutes, he raged about it. He's like, Dr. Pibb. And it, to the point where I think at the end of the meal, he's like, should I even tip her? After that Dr. Pibb comment, I don't know that I want to tip her. Anyway, I laugh a little bit about it all these years later. I don't know why it amused me so much. She was trying to please him, and she said, well, we have Dr. Pibb. And so Not long after that, I tried Mr. Pibb to find out what pissed Jeff off so much. And it was delicious. It was fine. It was Dr. Pepper. There is a difference between Pepsi and Coke. But I didn't think that there was a difference between Dr. Pepper and Mr. Pibb. And then a few years ago, gosh, I don't know when, let's say 2006 or 2007, somebody introduced, they changed the formula of Mr. Pibb and called it Pibb Extra. And it's divine. It's the greatest liquid. It is liquid. It is caffeinated ambrosia. And so I never cease to bring up how good Pibb Extra is. Or, you know, oh, we want to go to that Del Taco because they have Pibb Extra. And Jeff just, oh, he rages about it. And so I keep bringing it up. Pibb Extra is just delicious. And it's a shame I had to lose my last, it was my last one, in the car this way. And also, you know, stain the seats and the ceiling and my soul. Anyhow, I'm sorry about that. We're going to pick up with The Ugly Table. I'll play the whole thing and then I'll get to apologizing. But one more reminder, this story has language in it, it has adult themes. It was written by Rish Outfield, so consider yourself warned. And if you can, enjoy. Oh, and I'll meet you on the other side for a Dr. Pibb.
Not a great example. But I think it's just them. That bunch. They're all somehow way more attractive today than ever before. How? I said again. I don't know. But it would be cool to find out. She was right. We decided to follow the girls after school. Spider took Shane's cell phone number, since I didn't have one, and picked fat Alberta Sorensen to follow. Shane didn't own a car, so he and I would try to follow Hamie Salerno in mine, just to see where she went. What if she goes home? I asked. Wouldn't you want to compare notes with the other beauty club members after school? Spider replied. She seemed to be pretty smart, despite her appearance, and her mouth, and how she did in school. To our surprise, fat Alberta, or the now curvy, attractive Alberta, drove out of town with Trina Bosch in the passenger seat. We followed her onto the freeway and then off it again. In the city, she pulled into the big PetSmart parking lot and parked her car, talking to Trina. Next to PetSmart was a Bed Bath & Beyond, and that's where Shane and I parked.
Man, I can't get over how good Alberta looks, Shane said. She must have had one of those all-liquid diets.
I don't think you can change that much from a diet.
What about that black chick from American Idol?
I considered it. Well, she was probably always pretty. Just heavy, you know?
Can you imagine how great Alberta Sorensen would be in the sack? He asked.
Well, I could now.
Fat girls are the most generous lovers anyway.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Everybody knows that.
I swear, I learned more from Shane than I ever did in my classes.
It's called condensation. Like when a blind guy can hear better than everybody else. A fat girl just tries harder to please the guy she's with. It's science.
Well, she wouldn't have to anymore, I said. But she does look good.
And that other girl, Trina? I'm thinking three-way.
Crap. Now I was, too. Shane, I said, what you're feeling isn't real. It's like a drug or something.
Yeah, Viagra.
No, I think these girls are... They're still plain or ugly. Well, except for Meg Card. If you slept with Alberta, she'd still be fat, even if you couldn't see it.
You mean I'd feel it? Shane asked.
Then the corners of his mouth started to rise.
One way to find out.
I thought you wanted to go for Hamie Salerno.
Any port in a storm, bro.
Another car pulled into the lot, right next to Alberta's. It held three more pretty girls, all from PHS. Shane's phone rang. It was Spider. Shane listened, then told me,
Amy Salerno went to the Pound.
Pound?
The one on Geneva Road, right off the freeway.
Outside, the five girls went as one across the lot and entered the pet store together. Pet store, Pound, I thought aloud. Shane hung up, started to say something, then his phone rang again. He said,
All right,
then passed the phone over to me.
Somebody else is at the Pound, too. And Spider doesn't like it when you hang up on her.
As opposed to the rest of us, who love it, I muttered. Trina Bosch exited PetSmart with a small plastic bag in her hand. A moment later, so did Becca Carlson, accompanied by a girl from the ugly table I didn't know. She had the most beautiful red hair I'd ever seen. They could make commercials about it. Last, Fat Alberta came out. She had a large cardboard container in her arms. I saw the tail of a cat sticking out of it. While we had been absorbed in this little stakeout, a large van had pulled into the parking lot across from the first two cars. Ex-pizza face Jessica Forco was driving it. They all conferred for a few moments, showing off whatever was in the bags to each other, then returned to their respective vehicles. They were met by a fourth car 10 minutes later.
Who's in there?
Shane asked. I can't tell. She was blonde, whoever it was. I found myself straining to get a look at her, or hoping she'd turn. I so wanted to see her face. I started to say, Guess gentlemen do prefer... Shane's phone rang on the seat between us. I answered it, since he didn't want to. You'll never friggin' guess where Salerno is now, Spider told me. Then, before I could try, she said, They're at Petco in Orem. Her and Megan Card and some bitch I don't know. What are they doing there? Applying for jobs. How the hell should I know? I told her there were at least 7 girls here, all hanging out in their cars, waiting for something. Same shit here. Another car just pulled up next to me. It's Kathy Ellington. She drives a goddamn Prius. What does she want? I wondered. Nothing yet. She's looking at herself in the mirror.
I would too, I supposed.
Spider snorted after a few seconds. She's going in. She never even noticed me.
What's going on?
Shane asked me. I put up my finger. In the pet store? Hey, put numbnuts on the line, she suggested. Who, Shane? Anybody with ice-cold balls will do, she said. I shrugged with my eyes and handed the phone back to him.
What?
It was clear Shane didn't want to talk to her, and whatever she was saying merited only single-word answers or grunts.
Yeah?
He finally said.
What's she got? He looked at me. Some Asian girl bought a ferret.
Across the lot, the van started up its engine. It pulled out of its spot and was followed by the new car, then Alberta's, then Becca Carlson's Jeep. Shane told Spider this.
She says to follow them, he told me.
I started up the car and slowly pulled out of my space.
Oh, and she says you're a gay butthole.
Does she really? I asked. But it wasn't necessary, since it was Spider Hollister we were talking about. I followed the Jeep out of the lot, then on to University Parkway.
Not too close, Shane told me. Hang back a ways.
I smiled. This was a bit spy-esque.
Yes, I'm still here, Shane said into the phone. Because you're not saying anything.
I heard something loud and presumably profane through the cell phone's tinny receiver.
You kiss your uncles with that mouth?
Shane asked, before pushing the end call button. Ahead of us, the van in the lead signaled left and pulled into that lane. Afterward, the others followed. I did so too. Which one do you think's hottest? I asked Shane.
Of the babes in front of us?
Finally, a conversation he was interested in.
Probably that redhead, bro.
I think that...
It's weird, he continued. because redheads aren't usually that cute. It's like they lost out in the generic lottery or something, you know? But
I didn't correct him. In ancient times, they used to see red hair as a curse from God.
Well, people made sense back then. Today, a baby can be born with no arms and legs, and they tell everybody it's special. Teach him to like being a weeble-wobble, as if...
I tried to get a word in edgewise. They used to say Judas is... He wasn't listening.
But that girl, she was just perfect. Like if somebody made a girl in a computer. Like that movie, you know? Designed her. Do you know her name? I think she works in the office in the mornings.
I thought about it, and remembered a slouchy, deathly pale, gross-looking freckle-monger who took sick notes in the office and sometimes read announcements when the regular girl wasn't there. Her name had been Lisa or Liza or something. I realized this was the same girl. It had to be hypnosis. The four vehicles were in a mini-convoy and were easy to spot, so I let them go on ahead until two blocks were between us.
Dude, you're gonna lose them,
Shane said when the jeep disappeared down the hill in front of us. I sped up, seeing the four cars lined up to get on the freeway going south toward home. Shane's phone rang again. It played the theme from Mission Impossible. He didn't move to answer it. Why don't you just keep her on the line? I asked.
You want to listen to her talk?
He asked me, holding the phone out. She asked for you, I told him.
He answered the phone, then muttered, "You are."
I got in the turn lane for the freeway, and Shane said,
"That's where we're going too."
The other girls were also on the freeway now, apparently all headed south. It was 10 minutes before we reached our exit. During that drive, I got passed in a pink VW convertible by Corinne Blocker. She looked so hot, I found myself waving to her as she went by. She only glared at me. By the time we got to Praisedon, both groups had reached each other, and there was a line of 7 vehicles in front of us, all exiting together. In my rearview mirror was Spider in her Mustang, and when I waved to her, she flipped me the bird. I liked the pretty girl's reaction more. We drove through the center of town, passing the Shop and Go, the park, the elementary school, and where the Fruish Theater had been before it burned down. I started lagging behind again, and Spider kept tailgating me, which I've always hated. Finally, I pulled onto the soft shoulder and allowed her to pass. She threw her hands in the air as she drove by, and a second later, Shane, who still held the phone, asked,
"What's a smegma?"
Outside of town, there were only farms and wilderness. The convoy pulled into a driveway with an arch over it and parked alongside a fence where horses were grazing. We drove on past, parking on the side of the road about a quarter mile up. Spider's car peeled into the spot beside mine, and she was out the door before the dust settled. "Jesus, you drive like somebody's old man," she grumbled when I too got out. "Who drives under the speed limit?" "The car's old," I said. "It won't go faster than 50. "Save it, Grandma," Spider said. "You even know how to shift gears?" Shane also got out and stood by my side, giving an unspoken challenge to the loud-mouthed, unnecessarily hostile girl. "They all got pets," Spider said, ignoring Shane completely. "What for?" I asked.
"For a class?"
Shane guessed. Spider just shrugged, thinking about something. "So what now?" I asked. Spider shrugged again. She seemed unwilling to make small talk.
"That's the Blocker farm," Shane said, pointing behind us. "They have lots of animals."
"But what are they all doing there?"
"Maybe they're having a sleepover," he said. "Can you imagine it? Painting each other's toenails, having pillow fights, wearing lingerie, and..."
"It's not even 5, I said. "And it's a school night."
"A guy can dream, can't he?"
"Keep dreaming, loser," Spider said. "Let's check it out." "So we just go over there and knock?" She looked over at the farm. There was only a pasture from here to there. "Let's cut across. Sneak through that way." Why? She scowled at me. Because that's what we're doing. Now move your pale ass.
Pale? He's two shades darker than you, Shane said, getting my back.
She moved over to the barbed wire fence. There was greenery all inside, with a grazing cow here and there. I'll kick both your asses, whatever color they are, she said. Shane and I shared a look, then we hurried over beside her. No cars were coming, so we all climbed the fence and made our way through the pasture to the Blocker farm. What if we get caught, Shane? I whispered, though no one could hear us out here.
By the ugly girls? I can think of a worser fate.
Did you just quote The Little Mermaid? Spider asked, and for once, she sounded amused. I meant by the cops, I said. For what? Trespassing? We won't, Spider said. But what if whoever owns this land sees us and... Shut it, and try not to step in cow shit. I looked down. It was a hazard. I watched where I was going instead of whatever I was watching before.
Incoming,
Shane said. A moment later, a little too loud. Up ahead, cows were running toward us. At least three of them. I froze. Were those male cows protecting their territory? I didn't know, having never frequented farms or dairies. Should I be running right now? I asked.
They're only spooked, Shane said.
The cows stampeded past, running away from something rather than toward us. We looked up ahead, but I couldn't see anybody there that might have chased them. The pasture went all the way to the edge of the Blocker farm. A large fence separated the properties, and beyond it, there were shacks, a storage shed, a tractor, a big old barn, and something that might have been a chicken coop. I saw no people. With little difficulty, we crossed over the fence and onto the Blocker property. I kept looking around, guiltily, feeling very much like a little kid. What do we say if somebody catches us? They won't, Spider said.
We'll say we're after a kite that flew into their yard, Shane suggested.
And what happens when they want to see the kite? I asked.
Well, we'll say it was a baseball then,
Shane said, which really didn't help much. Spider was also looking around, a cross between a smile and a pout on her face. She was enjoying this, I supposed. Shane and I shared an uncomfortable glance. Okay, the house is over there, I pointed. It was a big farmhouse, built 100 years or more ago, with newer additions built on, with no attempt to make them match. It had a lot of windows, on both its ground and upper floor, and it would sure be easy for someone to look out and see us sneaking up on.
Hey, Shane hissed, drawing my attention. The van!
He was pointing back farther in the farm, where the van we'd seen Jessica Forco driving at the pet store sat parked. It had been backed up to the barn door, and its rear doors were open. No one was around. Spider started moving. As silently and as quickly as we dared, we snuck to the barn, and long before we reached it, we could hear female voices chattering inside.
Already, damn it,
I heard someone ask.
Because it has to be at sunset or at midnight,
someone else replied. I thought it might have been Jessica.
You want to have to wait until then?
Then there was a new sound, a male sound. It reminded me of the moaning of a mummy in a Hammer horror film or an episode of Scooby-Doo. Spider ran to the side of the barn then, and Shane and I followed. We pressed ourselves against the barn's wall, listening to somebody inside say, "Shut up!" That sounded like the beautiful Meg Card to me. But it couldn't be. It was too nasty, too full of ugliness.
All right, then,
another female voice said inside.
What now?
Spider made some sort of hand signal, but I only caught the end of it and had no idea what she wanted. Shane got it, though, and started inching down the wall toward the corner. I followed, something I seemed to have done a great deal on this day. When Shane stopped, I understood what Spider had been signaling. There was a space between the boards where we could look inside, and all three of us squeezed ourselves in together to see what was going on in the barn. Wow.
It was a teenage dream come true. The gaggle of hot babes were in various states of undress in there. Several of them had slipped into some kind of robe or cloak, and one, Catherine Ellington, was down to her bra and panties. I found myself going from 0 to 10 on the arousal meter in an instant. The ugly table were getting into some sort of costumes, like monks wore or something. But there was a veritable banquet of pale flesh to be glimpsed before I saw what else was in the barn. A table had been set up in the center of the floor, surrounded by some kind of circle, and unlit candles were at each end of it. In the corner, a stack of boxes from 2 different pet stores mewed, clawed, or shuddered. And in the pile of hay beside it, a man was laying face down in fetal position. He appeared to be a full-grown adult, and I realized that he was tied like a hog or a calf at a rodeo, with his arms and legs stuck together. He rotated his head in an uncomfortable-looking way, and I saw that he was both gagged and blindfolded. Blood was trickling from beneath the blindfold, and I further realized that we were witnessing something bad here, something that sent my erection packing. The pretty Asian girl began to dance as she slipped her robe over her clothes, exclaiming, "I'm so excited!" "I know," Becca Carlson laughed. "You should have seen the way the boys in geometry looked at me." "Tell me about it," the one I didn't know said. "That must be how the cheerleaders feel all the time." "Not for long," Jessica Forco muttered. And there was absolutely no joy in it, no humor. She wore the same robe as the others, but hers was purple, where the others were gray or brown. She slipped off her socks and shoes, then reached under the folds and pulled her panties off as well. But I couldn't enjoy this. I kept looking back at the hog-tied man on the dusty yellow straw in the opposite corner. Suddenly, our view was obscured as someone stepped in front of the crack in the barn. I held my breath. Spider dropped to her knees. "Sun's almost down," the girl standing there said, sounding anxious.
"Almost time," Jessica said.
"Who has the knives?" Meg Card asked.
"Ooh, I do, I do,"
someone announced. Knives. Below me, Spider shook her head. I looked at her. She knew what was up, and I guess, at least subconsciously, I did too. Whoever it was moved away from the corner, and Shane and I put our eyes to the space again. One of the girls, Trina Bach, had opened her backpack, and the others were collecting what might have been steak knives from a box. Jessica put the hood of her robe up, obscuring most of her face.
"Everyone form a circle. At sundown, take your oblations and place them on the altar. Becca, Alberta, help me with mine."
She was in charge, and sounded so confident, so unlike the girl I'd known in 9th grade journalism class. That girl had been bookish and so shy her face was permanently flushed. A little curious, a little sweet. Not like this.
"The animals," Spider muttered.
"What?" Shane asked beside me.
"Shh. They're a sacrifice. Every girl is going to kill an animal. And then..."
She stopped talking. I understood what she was saying.
"But why?"
Shane wondered.
I was glad he wasn't 3 steps ahead of me this time.
"Don't you get it?"
Spider asked.
"It's a fucking human sacrifice for a black mass or some crazy shit."
"That's how they got so hot," Shane realized. "From magic."
"There's no such thing as..." I began, but shut up. Obviously, there was such a thing, and it had worked wonders on the ugly table girls. I wondered if magic could make me taller and more muscular and fade the birthmark on my left arm and make girls want me all the time. But then I thought of that dude, the guy tied up in the barn. It ended my speculation.
"We gotta stop them," I said.
"How?"
"Call the police."
Spider nodded.
"Right now. She said they would do it at sunset."
I pulled Shane's cell phone off his belt. He didn't protest.
"What will we say?"
I asked.
"The truth," Spider answered.
But we can't. She grabbed the phone and stormed off with it. I followed her. Shane stayed behind, watching the spectacle inside the barn. Spider stopped a few yards away, beside the chicken coop. Just as I reached her side, she dialed 911 and immediately started to whimper. In a teary, scared-sounding voice, as unlike her own as Jessica's a minute before, Spider Hollister told the dispatcher that she was on the Blocker farm and there was a man in the barn around back, and he tried to grab her, but she got away, but he got her little sister and he was going to hurt her or kill her or something, and won't somebody help her? She made a hitching sound, then whispered, "I think he sees me. I've got to go." And she hung up. She handed me back the phone. There were tears in her eyes and on her cheeks. Whoa. It almost made me want to cry, too. "You didn't give him the address," I said. "Blocker Farm, numbnuts," she told me, wiping her face. "And if they do that triangulation thing they do on TV, it'll still lead them here." I put the phone in my pocket. This was getting more and more surreal. We quietly went back to the barn, where Shane was still watching through the crack.
"Police coming?" he whispered.
"Yeah. Miss anything?"
"What? Like them lezzing out?"
"Well, I..."
"No, just chatting."
Shane signaled for both of us to take a look, and I saw the side of Spider's mouth go up, wanting to smile. This was all a barrel of laughs for her, I supposed. Well, I wasn't having a swell time, despite all the practically naked hot chicks right before my eyes. I realized that my armpits were moist and that I was sweating up and down my back. I also had to go to the bathroom. But I looked again through the crack, into the barn. All the girls had their robes on now and were standing in a line with their backs to us. One of them was humming. It was, unless I had lost my mind, our high school's school song. The sun was going down now. I turned to Spider and saw that she wasn't looking in the barn. Instead, she was gazing at Shane, the light playing on his hair like a cruise line commercial. And it hit me. She had a thing for my best friend. That was so hard to believe. It almost made Spider Hollister a human being. Jessica Forco said something inside the barn. Whatever it was, the ugly table began to place their rats, kittens, ferrets, and basset hound onto the altar. Jessica muttered something, and the two biggest girls, not quite fat anymore but still on the beefy side, hefted the man up onto the altar. He bucked and moaned and knocked two of the candles off the corners. They weren't lit, otherwise the hay probably would have caught fire and... well, that would have solved things, wouldn't it? A couple of the girls picked up the candles, and Hamie Salerno took her cigarette lighter and set each one aflame. I glanced back to where the sun was all but extinguished in the sky. Probably a minute or two left. The cops weren't going to make it in time. "We have to do something," I hissed to the others.
"Like what? Bust in there, guns blazing?"
Shane's question wasn't a bad one. If the cops got here too late, they could still catch the girls. But that guy and those poor animals would already be sacrificed. The girls were chanting now. It might have been Latin, but it didn't sound like any of the movies I'd seen. Something tightened in my stomach when I heard it. I looked over at Shane. The hairs on his arm were standing up. The chanting stopped. Something inside spoke.
"My daughters,"
it said. It wasn't a voice I heard with my ears, but inside my head. I wanted to look into the barn and see what was talking, but I also didn't want to look. Spider got an idea. She picked up a broom that leaned against the side of the barn and hefted it into the air. "They have knives," I whispered. She rolled her eyes and, as quietly as possible, slid it into the two handles of the barn door, effectively trapping them inside. It made a clatter when it settled, though, and one of the voices inside asked, "What was that?" I took a deep breath of air and was surprised when Shane began to shout,
"This is the police! Stop what you're doing and put your hands up! You are surrounded!"
He deepened his voice a little, and spoke with so much authority, even I would have been convinced. Inside the barn, one of the girls swore. That strange voice in my head spoke again, and I heard Jessica Forco shout, "Don't break this circle!" But it was too late. Somebody pushed against the barn door, and the broom held it firm. Someone banged on the door, and I heard crying from within.
"No!" Jessica bawled. "Stupid!"
There was a siren wailing somewhere, coming closer. Suddenly, I wanted to be out of there. Shane met my eyes. He was sweating. He wanted to go too. Spider, however, was smiling. She was going nowhere.
"We have to go," I whispered.
Shane didn't agree with me. He just started moving. The barn door shook as someone kicked it or slammed against it. Spider smirked and opened her mouth to say something.
"Hey," I hissed, "we gotta go."
She looked conflicted, but started after me as I headed back toward the fence. Shane was there first, holding the barbed wire open so we could slip through. As I waited for Spider, I could see the flashing lights of the police car, or cars, pulling onto the Blocker farm.
"What if they saw us?" I asked.
"The cops? There's no way they..."
"No, those girls. They were going to kill that guy. Maybe they already did."
Spider reached us, slipped through the fence, lost her balance, and grabbed onto Shane to keep from falling. He held her for a minute, then said,
"Who cares?"
"What?"
Spider demanded, pulling away from him.
"Who cares if they saw us? They're the ones in trouble, not us."
"Oh no," Spider said. "They were into some serious shit, Shane. Like witchcraft devil demon stuff. We'd better hope they didn't see us."
Maybe Shane wanted to agree, but he stayed silent.
"We should go," I said for what seemed like the 25th time.
Spider shook her head.
"Let's watch what happens."
But we couldn't even see the front of the barn from behind the fence, and I wanted to get out of there and start forgetting about all of this. Eventually, Shane sided with me, and we moved back toward our cars. The cows in with us were now mostly dark shapes, all at the far end of the pasture. Spider stood still, watching the flashing police lights, and finally turned and ran to catch up with Shane. I wondered if he was seeing this new attention from her, or if you had to be outside to recognize it. I wondered if anybody could be in a relationship with someone like her, if anyone could even be attracted to Spider Hollister, for that matter. We made it to the cars, and Spider said,
"Look, we can't tell anybody what we saw, all right?"
"What did we see exactly?"
Shane wondered.
"I think she means that we don't want to be involved. Just keep quiet about it."
Spider scowled at me. It seemed to be her default expression.
"I also mean that these bitches might want to know who narked them out. And if they'd gain beauty from sacrificing a homeless guy, they'd try it with you."
"He was a homeless guy?"
Shane asked.
"Or whatever," she hissed. "God!"
"Okay," I said, trying to placate her. "We won't talk about it."
"To no one. Not to one of your little girlfriends, Shane, or to one of your boyfriends."
"Get bent," I said, but didn't really feel her insults. I had seen a human side to Spider today, and I thought her nastiness was an act. She was just like anybody. Just like me.
"You either," Shane said. "No telling your dominatrix buddies, okay, Spider?"
And they laughed.
The next day at school, things were back to normal. There was talk that a couple junior girls had been arrested, but they were all at school as usual. Jessica Forco had light patches of acne she had poorly covered over with makeup, maybe a mole or two. Alberta Sorensen had put on 20 pounds, and Becca Carlson was fatter than ever. Meg Card still looked pretty, but her hair was flat and limp, and her boobs had shrunk since yesterday. Heck, she had shrunk an inch or three. The ugly table was ugly again. I saw Spider in the hall in between classes and approached her to ask if she knew what had happened to Jessica Forco, what the cops had done. But then I stopped. Something had changed. She was smiling. Her clothes were brighter. She'd taken the ring out of her eyebrow.
Hey, look at you, I said, sharing her smile. I'd never noticed before. She was kind of cute when she didn't purposely try to look. What? She asked, her warm brown eyes suddenly cold. She hadn't ever been cute before. I was a teenage boy. I would have seen it. If it had been there before today. But now she was slimmer. Her hair was vibrant and seemed longer. Not bad, Spider Hollister. Not bad. Nothing, I said, and tried to shrug it off. I thought it was time to get myself to class. The end.
Okay, and that is the end of the second half of The Ugly Table. We now pick up the afterword already in progress. Anyhow, I hadn't revisited that story since I sent it to a fan of the show who volunteered to put it up there, or to format the file. And I can't remember what it was that made me want to record it, but I did do that. And while I was recording it, I thought, well, you know, there's probably some stuff in here that people might find offensive. Not intentionally, but, you know, there's some language, as I mentioned before, and then, you know, just thematically, just, you know, the whole judging somebody by how they look is, well, it's very adolescent, and a lot of what I write is juvenile. It's sophomoric, if you will. But I wondered about that. I wondered if, you know, somebody could hear that and be like, you know, this isn't cool. Or, you know, it's mean that there are two fat girls and you mentioned that they're fat girls and all that. And yeah, I'm not unaware of that aspect of this story. And I do apologize if that's offensive to you. I didn't mean for it to be an offensive story, if it is. I meant for it to be a funny story, an interesting story, and a scary story. And, I don't know if you can do both, if you can have one be funny and scary. But I really like the character of Spider Hollister. Just that anybody could be that abrasive is kind of amusing to me. And I guess that besides being problematic, you know, with, again, judging people by the way they look and maybe the meanness. I mean, the very idea of an ugly table is so high school. It's just cruel. And high school is cruel. But I didn't intend to be cruel with the story. Just that's what it was. But while I was reading it, I found a bunch of little things that I didn't like. I found a couple of typos, not a lot, probably between 3 and 6 or 5. But I found lots of things that I wanted to change, little phrases and things. I broke my cardinal rule, and you know what my cardinal rule is, because I say it a lot. I say it here and I say it on the Doonstief. You have to read your story out loud. You have to. You will catch things you will never catch just reading it with your mind, with your eyes, you know what I mean. And I had never read Ugly Table out loud. And so, if you have that copy of Ugly Table that came in the pretty ugly broken mirror version that Big and I sold, then I invite you to compare the two versions. I'm trying to think, a few years ago, Stephen King put out a revised version of The Gunslinger. And yet, people don't really talk about it the way that they talk about the revised version of The Stand. But the revised version of The Gunslinger, before it came out, was advertised as being, you know, extensively revisited by King. And they said that Every single page has changes. And they, I almost want to say that they said every single paragraph has changes, but, geez, I don't know. But yeah, there were so many changes that every single page had an addition or a clarification or something omitted that he didn't like. And yeah, the difference between The Ugly Table 2015 and The Ugly Table 2013 it should be quite night and day. Well, it's not night and day, but there are changes to every single paragraph in there. It's just, once enough time passes, you're able to look at things objectively. You're able to say, oh, I don't like the way that this sentence goes, or I can see what I was trying to say there, but I didn't quite say it. And then every once in a while, it's like, wow, I have no idea what I was trying to say with that sentence. And so I made a lot of changes, extensive changes. And, you know, to get back on Stephen King, around the year 2000, he wrote a book. Was it 2000? I don't know. He wrote a book called On Writing. And at the very end of the book, I've told you this before, but I'm saying it again. At the very end of the book, he had an excerpt, like the first 10 pages or 5 pages, of a story he wrote called 1408. And it's a story that got made into a movie with John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson in it. And he showed us the first 10 pages of the original manuscript, the first draft manuscript. And then it had like little changes and notes and things that were crossed out. But it was only the first 10 pages. And it might not even have been 10, it might have been 5. And that was fascinating to me. I got more out of those 5 pages than I did out of the whole rest of the book. Because even in the year 2000, I felt like I could write, but I didn't know how to make my writing better. I didn't know how to find things that needed to be fixed, and I didn't know how to look for things that could be improved. And so seeing the two versions of 1408, or at least the first act of 1408, was tremendously helpful for me. And I really wished that he had done the whole story, or that he had done a lot more of that, of saying, because, you know, we saw things that he crossed out, but he didn't say why he crossed this out. And some were self-explanatory, which is like, oh, purple prose, or that's kind of clunky, or, you know, this addition could make that line funny, whereas originally it was just a straight line. And so it may be helpful. Now, I realize I'm comparing myself to the great Stephen King, and that sounds arrogant, but it may be helpful to a reader to check out those two versions of The Ugly Table. I'm much happier with this version, just because there's lots of little fixes of nitpicks, little things that I, you know, they sounded wrong when spoken aloud. And so those were the two things I wanted to say. It's not been a long episode except for the story. Yeah, I could revisit the theme of the story, and I don't know. There was a story called, a book called Uglies, by Paul Westerfeld, is that his name? Paul Westerfeld? Is it Paul? Now I'm thinking of, what was the name of the singer for the Specials? That was Paul Westerberg, right? Oh, geez. I don't know if I'm getting the name right. But anyway, he wrote a book about an alternate universe where you could be made beautiful, where everybody that is flawed can have an operation when they reach a certain age, I think it was 16, and be made beautiful. And the world he had created was really nasty. Very self-centered, very, again, high school. And there were characters that were just repugnant. But I thought about it. And I talked to my friend, I talked to Big, who had also read the book, and I said, You know, as much as I was repulsed by some of the stuff in this book, I would have been one of those who couldn't wait to be pretty. I would have been one of those who looked down on anybody who hadn't yet had the surgery and felt like I was better. I would have been worse than the characters in this book, because I would give anything to be pretty. Now, I don't know if I wrote Ugly Table before or after that conversation, because that doesn't enter into this. You know, the experience of me reading that book is not present in this story. It might have been 2012, 2011 I wrote this, I don't know. But, shoot, it could have been earlier than that. But I could write a story that's that other point of view. Because, now granted, see, I'm an old man. And I am, I've blocked out most of it, as you know. But I'm still a lonely person. But gosh, oh, am I loneliest? It was just an echoing, resounding din of, you are alone. Nobody is ever going to love you. It was like being in some kind of giant, empty grain silo with just the sound reverberating off of the tin around me. And so, you know, I've lived a lot of years being lonely. And thinking, if only I, you know, if I could only be, if I were only that guy, you know. And that, I think, is fodder for an interesting story. It's not that I haven't written those. I wrote a story, was it in college or right after I got in college? I want to say that it was in college, where a guy does one of those body switching things, you know, you know what I'm talking about, right? There've been a dozen movies made where, you know, Freaky Friday, where a mom and a daughter switch bodies, or a geek and a stud switch bodies, or, you know, Prince and the Pauper kind of thing, right? Only body switching. And where this geeky kid gets to switch places with, like, captain of the football team. And the first thing he does when he becomes this big, muscular, popular person is beat the crap out of himself. And when I wrote that, I was like, oh my gosh, there is something wrong with me. The amount of self-loathing that I have to have, where that's the first thing that you do. It's not, you know, I go and I fuck every single girl in the cheerleading squad. That's, you know, a fantasy kind of thing. But that my fantasy would be, I seek out my body and I just beat the crap out of it. It horrified me. I've never shared that story with anybody. And I probably never will. So, I've written about that before, about my loneliness and about, you know, if only I could be somebody else. So if only I could step out of this shell and let you see who I am inside. Oh gosh, see, now I'm getting back to that very first point again. I got a lot of resentment for beautiful people, which isn't fair. You know, in the same way that I didn't ask to be unattractive, did they ask to be attractive? You know what I mean? It's just like, well, this is not by any design of theirs. But you know what? They can handle my resentment. They're beautiful. All right? You got a lot of open doors if you're beautiful. And see, there it comes, this attitude. This is why I was afraid of sharing this story while I was narrating it. Because I was just like, oh, you know, there is some attitude and maybe some negative attitude coming through in this story. I mean, it's part of who I am. It's part of life's lessons over the years. I made friends with this girl, this beautiful, perfect girl on the set of Spider-Man 3. We were just both playing pedestrians, and she was just so lovely. Holy cow. I wish I could come up with an actress that she looked like so you could say, oh, yeah, yeah, she's pretty. Shoot, yeah, there's one in the back of my mind, but maybe I'm just remembering this actual girl. Anyhow, there was a day when I had been booked on another movie, but I had already been working on Spider-Man. I had my own wardrobe, and my agency booked me on this other thing instead of Spider-Man. And I called my agency and I said, no, 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 they're having me back on Spider-Man tomorrow. I really wanted to do Spider-Man. They said, well, we'll take you off that other movie, but, you know, Spider-Man's already full. So you'll have to go, just go early in the morning and be on the standby list. And they'll let you be a standby because, you know, you've already worked on it and you've got the wardrobe.
So I got up, and my memory is that I got up at 5 in the morning. And I drove over there and I said, you know, I'm not on the list, but I've been here and that's my wardrobe right there. I could see my wardrobe hanging right there behind the AD's table. And I said, you know, just if somebody cancels, you know, I hopefully you'll let me work today. And this girl was there. And the two of us were the only ones who were on standby. So we sort of just hung out while everybody else was getting their fittings and filling out their vouchers and going to get breakfast and such. I don't know how long we hung out. An hour? 90 minutes? Something like that. The sun was coming up. And the AD came over and he said to the girl, okay, yeah, you can work. We got a spot for you. And said to me, sorry, man, you got to go home. So, you know, I not only got sent home, but I had canceled another gig to do Spider-Man. Now, granted, that was my choice because I wanted to do Spider-Man. But anyway, I went home and felt sorry for myself. Boo-hoo, right?
Shoot, I'm not sure if I should have told that story.
I guess I was just saying that there seemed to be an undercurrent of... Maybe this is a nastier story than I usually share. Do you know what I'm saying? But, you know, at the same time, Big's story was so positive, you know? A little bit more wish fulfillment, I would think. Well, it's probably not a great duo because of the tonal difference in those two stories. But at the same time, that's exactly what we are going for with the broken mirror presentations. You can make a story that's really scary or really funny or really sad or really uplifting with the same premise. And so that's the story that I chose to write about, you know, somebody suddenly becoming beautiful. The one we were going to follow it up with was both wrote stories about a revenge crystal. And yeah, I think in that one, I took the road less traveled. I took the road where, you know, somebody learned something. You know, when you seek revenge, first dig two graves. Whereas Big had a character who just became more and more corrupted by this power. And I'm sure he doesn't feel the need to apologize for his story. And I guess I have been. I like Ugly Table. Yeah, there's a nasty edge to it, but I think it's a fun story. And I'm hoping that you liked it too. I don't know. The whole purpose of the Rish Outcast is to A, hear myself talk, and two, force me to put more of my stuff out there. And yeah, there are stories that I'll put out there that I'll say, ugh, this isn't a very good story. And there are stories on there that I say, oh, I like this story. They're going to be all over the place. I wish that I had a little bit more intestinal fortitude and drive. Drive is what it takes. I wish I had more drive to have there be more stories. More episodes where I present stories. But it takes time, and it takes a persistence. It just takes me saying, oh, I really
need there to be a story this month. And, you know, the story episodes take so much longer than the non-story episodes. What I think I need to do is do it like I did Birth of a Sidekick every single time. I record the story. I put it out for sale. I let some time pass. And then I do it a Rish Outcast with it. So that it's like the work that I did recording and editing the story is twofold. It's both for a Rish Outcast and it's both for, you know, the potential to make a couple of bucks. I think that works really well. Now, I'm not Scott Sigler and I'm not Cory Doctorow, but if I do it enough, or I make enough fans, or I get good enough, or work hard enough, or maybe it's just luck, guys. Maybe if it's just if I get lucky, then I will start to make a living from it. Then I will start to see returns on my investment. You know, frankly, just the number of people that said, hey, I really liked Birth of a Sidekick, and the number of people, which is very small, but they're out there, that bought a copy of it, has made that one completely worth doing. You know what I'm saying? And that one I edited twice. Once to have Marshall's voice and the music and stuff in there. Anyhow, I'm going to leave you on a positive note. I think beauty is rare. And it's kind of an amazing thing. And you can discover beauty where you didn't know it was. And there's an actress. We don't see her much anymore. But the guys used to talk about how insanely hot she was. And I'd be like, And then I saw her in person at a convention. I think I saw her in more than one convention. The first time I saw her, I'm like, this is... Yeah, oh, she's attractive. Don't get me wrong. She just doesn't do anything for me. But the second time, she was doing a Q&A, questions from the audience, and she was so nice to these people that are like me, geeks, lonely people, unattractive people. She was just really cool and cordial and grateful for their attention, and she paid attention to every single one. And I was like, wow, this girl is rad. And from that point on, I thought, wow, she is beautiful. And I saw what everybody else saw in her. And it's a shame that she doesn't really work anymore. Yeah, she probably hit 30. And it was like, okay, that's it. It's been a good career. See ya. So, you know, it's not just hormones and it's not just physical beauty. There's something else going on there. And I think with Patricia, with the girl that I suddenly developed feelings for, or suddenly developed an attraction to. I had feelings for her for a long time. As, you know, this girl that used to like me, and now I'm in Los Angeles and nobody is ever going to like me. But yeah, I think that was part of it. With her, you know, I have no idea what it was. Because it's not like she changed her hair or anything. She just went from somebody that I didn't really think of that way to somebody I did. But she probably had some really great beauty inside that I wasn't savvy enough to notice. And, you know, if I did offend anybody with this story, again, I'm not going to apologize, but I'm going to work harder on the next one to have a different point of view or to have a different attitude. And I think I can do it. You'll see.
Hey, guys, this is Rish Outfield. And this is a sort of addendum to the Rish Outcast. I recently spoke about, you know, I ought to be a little bit more self-serving with my podcast, my solo podcast. You know, whenever I have a project that you can buy or just some story that I'm working on, I need to share it with you or at least mention it. Try and generate interest, maybe get some feedback from people that say, oh, hey, that sounds like a wonderful idea, or, oh, hey, that sounds like a synonym for wonderful idea. You know me. So I thought I would share with you the short story that I am working on right now, that I'm working on the audio for right now. It is called Lost and Found. And it is about a boy who has the ability to find things. He had this power from a very young age, and his father had that same power. And his father is now dead. And so his mother has absolutely forbidden the boy, Will, from using that ability. I thought I would share with you the work in progress. I'm going to play with you a little scene where his Uncle Armin's boss's granddaughter has disappeared. And so Armin comes over to Will's mother's house and tries to recruit Will to help find this missing girl. Somehow he succeeds in the convincing, and so the scene you're about to hear is when Armin finally gets a meeting with his boss, who is Mr. Kassad. I'll just go ahead and let it play.
"Before we do this," Armin began, all of his bluster, his self-assurance, now fading. What little he had, that was. "But I'd like two things, right now. Your word on two things."
"Yes, yes."
"First, I want my job. Same crappy, low-paying job I had before. No special treatment or anything. I want to still have a job tomorrow, no matter how this goes today."
"Of course,"
Kassad said.
"And second?"
"Second, I'd like William here to go to college. Whether we find your granddaughter or not, he deserves..."
"We will, Uncle Armin,"
the boy said, but the kid sounded nervous. "He deserves a chance to make something of himself as an adult. He hasn't got a dad anymore, and the..."
"Yes, yes. I can set up a small scholarship in his name. By the time he is university-aged, it should be no problem."
"Thank you," Armin said. Kassad took a cardboard box out of a drawer and pulled a framed picture from it. It showed a cute little kid with black or dark brown hair, showing two missing teeth when she smiled.
"This is the most recent photograph I have that actually came from my granddaughter."
He handed the frame to Armin, not the boy, and Armin frowned. "Why? How old is this picture?"
"She is now 12.
That was confusing to Armin, but he let it go. "So, if this works, Willie will go there, look around, and come back here, telling us the situation, if the girl's all right." Kassad frowned. "Well, more than usual, anyway."
"Why not just retrieve Elspeth? You said he was able to..."
"First things first," Armin said. "If she's lost in the woods somewhere, if she's, I don't know, at a mall... If it's something worse, you'll want to know about it."
"Please, young man, go on."
Armin handed the frame to his nephew. He gazed at the girl pictured there.
"Wow, she's pretty."
"Make your attempt, boy."
Will looked from the stranger to his uncle, who gave him a smile and a nod. He held the frame in both hands and concentrated. He leaned closer to it and... was simply gone. The CEO lurched forward as if to catch the boy, or possibly the frame, but there was no need. The room was empty. Will saw bright lights first and thought he was outdoors, right under the sun. But it was too cool. He was someplace very well lit, indoors. A warehouse?
"Look, Chad,"
said a voice from his left. A child's voice. Will spun. His eyes accustomed themselves to the light, the bright light of photography lamps. Two twin boys, both dressed in identical, gross cable-knit sweaters, were staring at him in amazement. They were perched on a plastic replica of a porch swing, under a phony tree in front of a forest backdrop. A photographer's studio. Will glanced back at the photo in his hands of the missing girl. Dill Beck Studios, it had been stamped.
"Is he one of yours?"
a man asked behind him.
"No, not mine," a woman answered.
Will gritted his teeth. He'd have bet anything that's where he was now,
where the photo had been taken.
"That kid beamed in here," said one twin.
"Beamed?
From the Star Trek Enterprise."
"No, he didn't."
Behind him, the photographer was waving his hands. "Hello, little boy." Will looked at him, unsteady on his feet.
"Hi. Can we get you out of the frame, please?"
Will shrugged.
"Could I have a drink of water?"
The photographer pointed toward the exit sign.
"No, you may not. This is a scheduled appointment. Who are you here with?"
All right,
Will said. He turned back to the twin boys who'd seen him appear.
"Live long and prosper,"
he said, giving them the Vulcan hand salute. And then he vanished again.
So yes, that was an excerpt from Lost and Found, which is available to buy if you're interested. I'll provide a link right here in, as we used to call it, the show notes. And yeah, it would be greatly appreciated if you went out there and bought it. But, oh, sorry, just let me sit down for a minute. We'll talk just for a minute more. I don't know what projects to share with you here on The Outcast and which ones not to. It would be fairly easy to just say we're going to do Lost and Found over two episodes, or heck, we could say three episodes of The Rish Outcast, the same way that we did with Birth of a Sidekick. And there's nothing wrong with that. I would rather have people hear it and like it for free than never know that it exists out there to buy for money. But there's just got to be some that I sell and some that I give away. I think Birth of a Sidekick is a fine story. It's a better story than Lost and Found, right? In its way. I mean, I have more affection for Birth of a Sidekick than I do for Lost and Found. But who's to say which is a better story? I mean, they're different kinds of stories, even though they both have child protagonists. I feel like I've talked enough. I'm just going to do this again next time I have a project. And it can be its own episode or it can just be part of an episode. I haven't decided. If this is its own episode, then thank you for listening.
This has been Mini Rish Outfield. Good night.
Now, so thank you for coming on this journey with me. And take care.
The perfect way for the evening to begin. Now I'll play.
Oh no. The Rish Outcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives 3.0 license. Do you know what that means? That means you can share the bloody thing with anyone. But you can't charge for it, and you can't change it. This world is not a pretty place.
She said they would do it at sunset. I pulled out my cell phone. You don't have a cell phone. You already explained that.